I'm Will Hutton, and I've been a journalist for more than 40 years, a career that spans being a former editor of The Observer and spells at the BBC and Guardian. I've been an economist, and social science has always been the bedrock of everything I've done, the core of my books and my columns. This is episode 3 of season 3 of the We Society podcast. Whether you realise it or not, the social sciences touch all of our lives and provides us with the guardrails to create a better society, a one where the focus is on the we and not just the I. In every boardroom, high office and behind every government policy, you'll find a social scientist who's coming up with ideas to shape the world we live. In each episode, you'll be hearing from some of the UK's top social scientists to find out how they are changing the world for the better and shaping a we society. I hope you enjoy the We Society podcast, brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. There are many definitions of the good life, but there's one component in almost all of them, the role of exercise. Its powerful impact on individuals and communities is something that has fascinated social scientists for decades. Spool back to 1912. Sociologist Emil Durkheim coined the term collective effervescence, a group activity which describes the euphoric self-transcendence individuals feel when they move together. 100 years later, we had the London 2012 Olympics, where it felt the whole country was glued to their TV screens. And that's because we were. Around 52 million of us tuned in to watch some of the games. But while we're a nation adept at watching sport, we don't seem to be particularly good at taking part in it. We all instinctively know that taking part in sport's good for our mental and physical well-being, but why don't we do more of it? Professor Louise Mansfield is the bridge whose research focuses on the relationship between sport, public health and well-being, and she's needed more than ever. In 2017, just under 1 in 3 adults rated their life satisfaction as very high. Now it's less than 25%. She's Professor of Sport, Health and Social Sciences at Brunel University and is here to tell us more about her work. Welcome to the We Society.
Thank you.
Now, I always ask my guests what was their first reaction when we approached them to participate in a We Society podcast. What did you make of We Society?
I was thoroughly excited, Will. I mean, just the opportunity to bring and make visible the idea of sport, exercise and physical activity, its contribution, not just to how people feel, but to a kind of collective endeavour, which is what I think the We Society is focused on. And also the opportunity to think about some of the what I call cross-sector and the obvious interdisciplinary links between understanding sport and exercise, physical activity, and its contribution to society.
Now, this is a whole universe we're going to plunge into. We are going to look at teams, we're going to look at why people do it, we're going to look at the dynamics of it, we're going to look at why there's not more of it. But let's start with kind of getting a kind of big macro overview. I mean, when you think of social structures and class and gender and all the things, those categories that social scientists think in, they'll talk about inequality, they'll talk about human relations, they'll talk about productivity, but they rarely get to talk about sport. But, you know, how do you link sport into the kind of larger story that social scientists tell?
Yeah, I think the thing about sport, if you look back to its history and development, particularly in the UK, is that it is a class-based development. And that's also marked by particular divisions in gender throughout history. And I think in many ways sport is, I think it's probably a little bit simplistic to say it's a microcosm of society, but in fact, it probably is. It reflects many of the inequalities we know about around social class, disability, gender, and race and ethnicity. And I think it provides us with a forum for seeking to understand those, both historically and in a contemporary way.
Because we had rugby union and we had rugby league, the gentleman's game and the working class game. You know, you have greyhound racing and steeplechasing. Yeah. You know, I mean, you look everywhere you look. You know, Wimbledon is the pinnacle of the kind of English summer, kind of graced by royalty. class is there.
Yeah, class is there. I mean, my particular area of kind of expertise over time has been around gender relations in sport, but they intersect with class. So take tennis, for example. It's an exemplar of the way in which some women were able to be involved early in the 19th century, but that was entirely class-based. And so women of the middle classes were able to go to their tennis clubs to play a little bit of tennis, but probably to meet an appropriate husband. And I think that's a kind of key example of the way in which we see class developing over time, but also with the gender connections.
But if we just come back to today,
yeah.
Now, mm-hmm. I mean, we've got this, as I observed, I mean, sense of satisfaction with ourselves is falling.
Yeah.
And falling over the last kind of 5-8 years, and that seems to be across class. I mean, and there's a reluctance to participate in sport. What's going on?
Yeah, it's quite difficult to do for a number of reasons. I think people, when you talk to people about what they fear, what they don't like about sport, it always boils down to a number of factors. People claim they don't like the competitive elements. They feel that they can't do it. There's a kind of competency issue in that, a skill issue in that. People often say, and I'm not, sometimes this is more related to what women tell us than men, they don't like the feeling of getting out of breath and they don't like getting sweaty.
That's the whole point of it.
Yeah.
One of the whole points of it.
But a lot of that is a kind of historic fear, some bad experience they may have had in the past that becomes entrenched in the way that they think about it. And a lot of the work we've done has brought some of those things that people tell us they don't like to the fore, got people to try them, so put them into kind of small competitive situations, really simple ones. So, you know, throwing a beanbag into a ring and how many times can you do it? And then you get into a group and you see how many times you can do it against the other group. And it builds in the competition and people love it. So it's not entirely the competitive thing. People like the challenge. Probably what they fear is the extreme end of the competitive aspect, the people who are, you know, on an elite pathway, the ones that have been really dominant when you've been at school or in the playground or wherever you've taken part. So it's not actually the competitive element. It's a type of competition people don't like. They do like the challenge. And when you involve people in...
The type of competition. Yeah. I mean, I just think I'm just trying to figure out what that actually kind of means. Mm. I mean, I was very struck. I mean, we're talking the hour of the day after this test match, which the England cricket team lost by one run.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was striking when you heard Ben Stokes, the captain of the England cricket team, talk about it, was actually, you know, yeah, his team lost. But what a great thing it was, he said, to participate in one of the epic test matches in history.
Yeah.
And actually, that was a big deal for him.
Yeah.
So what was the nature of the competition going on there? He was just pleased to be in that arena at that moment? I mean, that was just... Or what's going on?
No, I think what it is people need to be involved in competition that they can cope with, that they have the skill set and the mental capacity to be involved in, that they have the kind of professional set of skills to deal with. And so Ben Stokes is clearly at the...
He can deal with
all of that.
And so can his team,
He understands that, you know, at that very high end of competition and professionalism, you can control the outcomes to a certain extent, but that actually you are working against a group of people who are equally as skilled and professional as you, and the margins for success are tiny. And he's there.
One run in this case, actually.
Whereas, you know, people who say, you know, they're involved in community sports or they're involved in sports at school and they say, oh, God, you know, I hate the competition of it and I can't do it. That space for them is just not the right environment for them to be involved, and other environments need
but
to be
sport
created.
Isn't just about competition,
no,
is
not.
It? I mean, come
no.
on, you can get on an exercise
yeah.
bike and compete
yeah.
against yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I play golf, I'm always competing against myself, actually. And rather than,
yeah.
I mean, it's quite nice in that sense, actually. I mean, I know golf is kind of written off as a kind of, you know, game for kind of, yeah. you know, the middle-aged and conservative-leaning members of the Rotarian Society. But actually, you know, it's so difficult to do that when your person you're playing against does a good shot, you applaud him or her.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know that you can hit it into the bushes yourself so easily.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, what you're trying to do is kind of You're competing against yourself in a good way.
Yeah, I think one of the most amazing potentials of sport for engendering all sorts of positive benefits is it provides these exceptionally diverse opportunities for people to take part in something that's meaningful to them, that can elicit all of these positive emotions that you're talking about. So you could be involved individually, as a pair, in a group, in a sport that's indoors, outdoors, with people that you know or that you don't know. And those diverse opportunities, I think, provide these outstanding opportunities for positive benefits.
Now, you're a social scientist. You're an apostle, an advocate.
Passionate.
For the role of sport. Mm-hmm. Let's go into the kind of some of the social science you've actually done.
Yeah.
Using social scientific tools, gathering evidence, marshalling it, interpreting it, kind of looking for correlations and causation. And you've done a big study in Hounslow.
Yeah.
London Borough of Hounslow over 3 years.
Yeah.
What was the object of that? What did you find and how did you set about it?
Yeah, just a tiny bit of background to that, because that developed from the work that I was involved in around the Olympic legacy. The London 2012 was the first Olympics to have a specific strategy for a legacy, and that was about increasing population levels.
That was my friend Tessa Jowell.
Yes.
She was very keen on that.
Yeah, and that led to some really strong investment around policy for community sport and specified outcomes for health, well-being, social, community and economics. It led to some specific funding strategies through Sport England's work. And that's how the project in Hounslow came about. So we were funded through a Sport England Get Healthy, Get Active campaign. And we developed a project called the Health and Sport Engagement Project. And it was a complex community intervention. And it worked across the life course in Hounslow with groups of people to ask them, if you were going to get involved in sport, what would it be like? Where would it take place? How would it be costed? Who would deliver it? And we co-designed those projects with a range of groups, sixth formers in schools, older people living in sheltered accommodation. We worked with a Somali group, a whole range of different groups. So we co-designed the projects. And we work specifically with sport coaches in order to deliver.
What's the nature of the work you're doing? What are you actually doing?
Yeah. So we are developing workshops. We're talking with people. We're giving people taster sessions around sport. We're asking them.
What, swimming pool or tennis court or what?
Yeah, all of those. Swimming pools, tennis courts, football, multi-sports in different settings. All of the activities they wanted to do, we gave them taster
sessions.
But weren't
doing or could do more.
But weren't doing. No, these were inactive people. These were people who were not taking part. So we talked to them in classic kind of focus groups around what they would want to do. We provided taster sessions, which we co-designed with the sports coaches in Hounslow. And from those, we developed a programme of 12 months of activity that these groups wanted to do. Most of those groups didn't want to do one single sport. Some did. The Somali group wanted to do football. But in other contexts, they wanted to do a whole range of different things. And so we put on a 12-month multi-sport program. And we evaluated that using a repeated measures questionnaire. It's quite a long questionnaire. And people were fantastic at filling it in 7 times. And we also had a really, really rigorous package of qualitative research involving observations and participant observations, interviews with people across those.
So how did you get these kind of couch potatoes get off their couch play sport?
I think the principal way in which we did this was to involve them from the start. And actually, before we even submitted the idea for this project, I was a volunteer in Hounslow as a community health champion. So that allowed me to get to know the structures, the organisation of, you know, what was happening in community sport, what wasn't happening in community sport. Hounslow at the time had a fantastic community sport and physical activity network where people from different sectors came together to discuss how they could use sport and exercise in order to promote health and well-being. And I think we also benefited at that time in 2013 from the devolvement of responsibility of public health to local authorities. So there was an appetite for it as well in the kind of local politics.
there's two things going on with sport, isn't there? I mean, there's actually more than two things when I think about it. I mean, one, there's social well-being, or your contribution to social well-being.
Yep.
The quote of Emil Durkheim I had at the beginning of the podcast, what does he call it? Collective effervescence. There's that. But there's also, actually, I mean, as I've got older, I recognise that actually having done sport has probably been beneficial to me in actually, you know, things last longer. I could do stuff that I notice that people my age can't do because, you know, they've been inactive. So there's that as well.
Yeah.
There's a public health component, reducing the growth in the National Health Service budget. And there's a lot of stuff going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what's fantastic about bringing this whole discussion to the we society, because the stuff that's going on crosses sectors, crosses disciplines in the social sciences. So we've got a project going on in Southall at the moment, which is all about thinking about sport and physical activity in a whole system. So it is about getting people more active and benefiting from the health improvements that we know happen and the personal well-being improvements that we know happen. But there's also a connection to growth, local growth, in terms of positive regeneration, creating nicer neighbourhoods, places where people can cycle and walk, places where people can gather together, let's say in parks, in order to walk or cycle or run or, you know, whatever it is they want to do from an exercise point of view, but get together as a collective. And I think there's been a, you know, we've done a little bit of work around the contribution of those kind of activities to decreasing loneliness, improving social interactions.
Just a quick break in the conversation to tell you more about the organisation behind the We Society podcast. We champion the social sciences and highlight the important role academics and practitioners have in all sectors of our society, whether that's business, health, government, education. The list is endless. It currently feels like the world's in a state of flux as we grapple with the ongoing war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, spiralling energy costs, climate change. The social sciences have a vital role to play in improving lives, and this podcast brings you the best ideas to shape the way we live. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read upon our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at @AcadSocSciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org. UK. Now, back to the conversation. What about this well-being agenda? Mm, I mean, can we actually measure well-being? I mean, how as a social scientist do you set about measuring well-being?
I think since 2010 in the UK, we've had a measuring national well-being programme. And the measures of personal well-being that have been particularly significant to the work that I've been involved in have been developed actually through the work of colleagues at the London School of Economics. And you'll know Professor Richard Lord Layard. And
A friend of mine, I play tennis with him.
Yes.
He's approaching his 90th birthday.
Yes,
he practices what he preaches.
Indeed. and his work and that of Paul Dolan has been significant in bringing together a measure of well-being. And so we do have a measure of well-being, personal well-being, in the UK. It's got four domains. It's about life satisfaction. It's about happiness. It's about worthwhileness. And then there's a question as part of that on anxiety. And that's how we measure. It's on a scale from 0 to 10.
So how am I going to judge, if I'm a listener to this podcast, I'm thinking to myself, okay, worthwhileness. Mm. I want to...
Yeah, but that's a sense of purpose. And I think in my experience, when you ask people that question, overall, how worthwhile do you think things are in your life? They can answer that really easily. They understand that that's about purpose. And there was some careful work around language and the development of those questions. And we brought them into actually the Health and Sport Engagement Project survey. And I think I was surprised, because like you, I think asking questions of people that are social science theory orientated raises a question of whether people can actually understand what they mean. And I think my most surprising aspect of those four measures of well-being in our health and sport engagement survey was around happiness, just how easily people could answer the question on happiness, how directly they linked it to the activity they were taking place, and how stable that measure was. And actually in that project, community sport, whatever type people were doing, was positively associated with increases in happiness.
Community sport always has a slightly, I'm trying to get the right word here, because I don't want to be pejorative about it, but you always have a sense of kind of, you know, I mean, I play a lot of tennis,
yeah.
and I wouldn't say it's a community activity, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there's very good public courts in Paddington Recreation Ground where I play on a Monday night, but yeah. I mean, that's a community investment, which I, you know. But
yeah.
I mean, there's also, I don't know, a kind of slight, kind of sorrowful, kind of sorrowful to mention this. I mean, I don't want it to be, can we find a different word from community? Can we make something that kind of that gives us, well, I want to be part of that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. As much as I'm passionate about all of this, it's too easy to romanticise the kind of collective effervescence or the community nature of it. And, you know, I think, yeah, we could probably find different words to talk about it, or at least recognise. And this has been, you know, really part of our long-time work, that the whole notion of sport does come with a slight image problem, in the sense that it is associated in a lot of people's minds with a bad experience, either at school or, you
exactly,
know, they felt
exactly,
they
exactly,
felt that
exactly,
they'd been
exactly, yeah.
excluded. They were picked last in the playground for the football team or to whatever the activity was. And so a lot of our work has been around challenging that image problem of sport, and the very word sport, people associate it quite narrowly with team games or with something exclusive or something they can't afford. And I think that's been part of the work, particularly since the Hounslow project, around saying to people, well, actually, if you go back to the European Charter definition of sport, it's any physical activity done for any reason. That is something
dancing
that we talk
sport.
About.
Dancing
is sport. Dancing is absolutely sport. And I think dancing is also performing arts. And a lot of the work we've done around the broader culture sector has, you know, over time led me to look at, you know, some of these interconnections between sport, culture and art. You know, and we go back to that question about
sport,
historical
culture and art.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we go back to that development of sport historically to recognise always that sport is an embedded part of our culture. It is a cultural activity as well as a physical activity. And it means, its meaning is derived from its cultural development and from the people who play it. So if you take dance as an example, there's all sorts of different versions of dance. Bollywood dance is associated with Indian culture. Ballet dancing is associated with all sorts of different cultures, from the UK through to Russia, through to all sorts of different cultures. So I think that connection between sport and culture is something that's really important to unpick. It allows us to understand also the inequalities that happen, but the potential of sport to bring different groups of people together. And it's what's been central to some of the work on refugees.
Now, refugees,
yeah.
We should just do a minute or two on that.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's a tricky area.
Yeah.
I mean, because I'm marginalised anyway, doubly marginalised,
yeah,
through lack of access to sport.
Yeah, and more than doubly marginalised by their experiences of coming to another country. And this work is led by one of our fantastic PhD students, Robin Smith, actually, who's been involved in refugee cultures as a volunteer, working with refugee services in order to develop an understanding of the community, really explore not just their challenges, but issues of ethics and trust in the development of leisure and sport programming with and for refugees. But it does come back to this principle that we started out with in the Hounslow project, that you need to work with and for people. You need to understand what it is they do and don't like about sport and what will work for them in developing a program. If you don't start with that, you know, it's the same with the work we did on the Olympic legacy. We challenged the idea of this demonstration effect, that if you just put something on, people will turn up. I mean, that doesn't happen with mega events. It might happen for a couple of weeks around Wimbledon, where people go out and, you know, take a tennis racket out and start to play. But it's not long lasting. What we promoted through the Olympic legacy work was the idea of the festival effect, that if you can enable people to see themselves as something, as part of something more than the sport, something bigger, something that's for them, that they can identify with, that they can have meaning and purpose from, then it can be, sport can be a fantastic way for engaging people for all sorts of reasons. And then they can get a multitude of benefits from it, not just health and well-being, but social connections. The refugee work has highlighted a slightly different but connected idea around well-being and capabilities. And the findings from that project have been that the sport and leisure provision, co-produced with the young refugees, has allowed them to fulfill the potential of feeling valued, affiliating and associating positively with other people, and getting a degree of autonomy in their life, being able to make decisions.
Now, this thing about purpose has been, that's kind of, as we've been chatting, that's been resurfaced a number of times. And I'm a great apostle of purpose in business life. I think companies with a North Star of purpose tend to outperform their peers, create value, strategy, allow you to navigate problems. I mean, purposeful organizations are very good to work for. And it has a lot of growing traction, actually, in business life, this notion. And it's interesting to think it's got growing traction in your world.
Absolutely. It's, I think, a central feature of the benefit of taking part. It's connected to
meaning. It sounds like
meaning.
up school, taking part. Don't take part, boy.
It's a central feature of being involved in any way. I mean, the other thing about sport is there's lots of different roles you can take. You can play, you can be a player, but you can also officiate, you can umpire, you can score, you can lead. There's so many things that are actually a part of that group endeavour. And even if you're doing an individual sport, like, you know, fell running or, you know, whatever it might be, you can still be a part of an organisational structure where you can get those benefits. And even in informal sport, and I'm fascinated by the idea of informality in sporting groups now, where you just, you know, pick up a ball and start to play something, or you get together once a week, you're not quite sure when it's going to be, but you've got a group of friends and you go and play your sporting activity. I think even in those informal environments.
Walking holidays or walking together.
Togetherness brings so many added benefits. And I think that is aligned with this idea of a sense of meaning and purpose. And I think that is a really strong element of one of the benefits of being involved.
You're a very passionate woman. I mean, you really are. I mean, you've been passionate for best part of half an hour. I mean, what's driving you?
Probably a history of positive involvement myself in playing when I was younger.
What's your sport?
Netball. And that has, and I played till I was in my mid-30s at a competitive level, but I've always enjoyed the feeling of being part of a group of like-minded people, but also working through with people you're not like-minded with. And I found that quite fascinating. And I probably would say that has had a very, very strong effect on my skill sets going into work and in other areas
what's
of my
your
life.
Biggest, what's your biggest success? What's your proudest of in your work?
In my work?
Yeah. I have a sense, I mean, you know, we had the Olympics. Tessa Jow was massively enthusiastic about leaving a legacy. But the legacy 10 years on, it's not that great, is it? Or is it? I don't know. I mean, I mean, that's my sense of it. Perhaps I'm wrong.
I think it's mixed. I think what I'm most proud of actually is the longevity of the type of work that I've been doing since, you know, 2013 and before, when we were involved in the Olympic legacy work. And I think there has been a legacy of the Olympic legacy itself, because it has brought sport into the political agenda. It has created policy around connecting sport to health and well-being.
That's true, isn't it?
It is true. Yeah.
And whether it's regulating football, whether it's higher up the political agenda than
I think so.
It's important. Yeah, I concede that.
It has left a funding legacy through the work of Sport England. They have had successive funding rounds to develop sport in local areas and in larger regional areas. They have at the moment funded what they call local delivery pilots, which are large regional investments to support the development of sport in those regions and to work through all the complexities around inequalities.
Is there evidence to support the notion that great sport, areas that have great sport, catalyse economic growth?
Yes, there is. And that was done through the work at Sheffield Hallam. They've been looking at, social return on investment. But there has been work done to demonstrate that there is a relationship there. Yeah. And I think that's underpinning all of this work around investment funding and policy towards promoting sport in regional and local contexts, as well as in national contexts.
And that's that broad European definition, any form of physical activity.
Done for any reason.
Well, you've convinced me. And I think you've convinced our listeners. Good. Louise, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
It's been a fascinating. Fascinating. You've taken us, we've gone from Durkheim, we've gone to the Olympics,
yep.
We've discussed teams, we've discussed its relationship with economic growth and its relationship with well-being. It's been a real kind of magical cook's tour. I can see why it animates you so much.
It does.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
And look forward to speaking to you again sometime.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to.